Recorded Books presents Beautiful by Danielle Steele, narrated by Nick Afka-Thomas. To my beautiful children, Beatrix, Trevor, Todd, Nick, Samantha, Victoria, Vanessa, Max, and Zara, may the challenges you face be small and rewarding. May you always be protected from harm. May you always be safe, happy, and loved. With all my heart and love, Mom, D.S. Chapter 1. The music was loud and throbbing as 50 strikingly beautiful models pounded down the white satin runner, carefully laid out between the chairs meticulously placed in rows. Mirrors reflected the images of the models and spectators. The models intersected with one another in a carefully choreographed pattern at the Chanel ready-to-wear show during Paris Fashion Week in March 2016. The images of the rapidly strutting models mingled with those of the crowd, and the bank of photographers captured each moment, each girl, each face in the crowd, showing the collection for the fall. Véronique Vincent was the first model they saw. She opened the show in a ruby-coloured coat, and she was the last in a revealing black velvet gown, which trailed behind her and offered more than just a glimpse of her breasts. She was tall and thin, but not quite as emaciated as some of the others. Many of the girls looked dangerously thin, with severe expressions, flawless makeup, and sculpted hair. The atmosphere was pulsating with excitement, like the music. Véronique had the smallest hint of a smile as she sailed past the photographers. They knew her well. She was the star of every show she walked in, and had been for the past 4 years. She had started modelling at 18. She had dark chestnut-coloured hair, naturally, but let the casting directors dye it any colour they wanted. She was famously easy to work with, and a consummate professional at 22. Some of the girls were as young as 15. Most were in their late teens, as she had been when she had started. Véronique had big green eyes and a ready smile when she wasn't working. Karl Lagerfeld, the famous Chanel designer himself, walked arm in arm with her when he took his bow at the end. She was a favourite of his, and the Chanel show was always the one Véronique liked best. It was flawless, just as she was. She walked in 2 or 3 shows a day during Fashion Week, and she had been dashing from one show to the next for the past 4 weeks. Fashion Week started in New York with the American designers and moved on to London for a few days after that to show the work of British designers. After London, Fashion Week went to Milan, and the last Fashion Week was in Paris, for closer to 10 days and a heavy schedule for the most important models. Véronique had the same grueling schedule in September when the designers in each of the 4 countries showed their spring lines. Other, lesser designers did presentations in which their clothes were modelled without a fashion show. The runway shows were major productions. They cost millions. And the decor was almost as costly and impressive as the clothes. Chanel was notorious for the most elaborate stage sets, designed by Peter Marino, who sat in the audience watching the proceedings, clad head to foot in black leather. The runway shows were a spectacle from beginning to end. The audience was comprised of magazine editors, store buyers, famous movie stars from around the world, the wives of heads of state, and illustrious figures from the fashion world. The haute couture shows, which were even more elite, happened in January and July, and Véronique was the star of those shows as well. She had been on the cover of every fashion magazine frequently for the past 4 years. It wasn't an easy job, and required endurance and hard work. She was often in fittings the night before a show until 2 a.m., while demanding designers saw to it that each garment fit each model perfectly. There was pandemonium backstage at every show, while stage managers from the design houses oversaw every detail, and in some cases, dressers stripped a model and redressed her in a matter of seconds, with all new jewellery and accessories to go with the change. Only their hair and makeup remained the same. Véronique took it all in stride. None of it was new to her after years of the same routines. During the rest of the year, she was constantly in photo shoots all over the world and had worked with all the most important photographers. She was always in high demand and had thrown herself into her career wholeheartedly, knowing that the crest of the wave wouldn't last long. One day, it would be over. She had made a lot of money and turned it all over to her mother, who had a good head for business and invested it well. Véronique had total confidence in her. Her mother, Marie-Hélène Vincent, was a lawyer, and Véronique was unusual in how close she was to her mother. Many of the young girls from Eastern European countries came to Paris unprotected to seek their fortunes, modelling for as long as they could and hoping to find a man to marry or support them. The men who pursued supermodels were a special breed, addicted to beauty, wanting a young girl on their arm. Some of them were extremely generous, others less so. They used the girls as accessories to enhance their image. Many of the girls got into drugs once in the fast lane, but Véronique never had. Her beauty had been striking since she was 13. Men in the streets stared at her, others tried to hustle her. She had been well protected and carefully brought up by her mother, who had insisted that her education came before her modelling career. For the first 2 years of her career, she had attended the Sorbonne part-time and majored in art history and French literature. She was halfway to a teaching degree she intended not to use until she was much older and had no other options. In the meantime, she had recently been the face of a well-known cosmetics line, and before that, the face of a perfume. Jewelry houses clamoured to have her in their ads, and she had been the primary model for an airline for a year. She never lacked for assignments, and had to juggle them all. She was part of an industry in which she was the commodity she was selling. Her mother was relieved that so far none of it had gone to her head, despite so much attention focused on her. Véronique treated it like a job she was serious about, and never let herself be distracted, as many other girls did, their heads turned by their own beauty. Her mother always reminded her that external beauty was fleeting, and real beauty came from within. It was part of her now, like a hand or a leg. Her exquisite face was just another body part, and it served her well. She didn't dwell on her looks and never thought of herself as others did. She was paid well for what she did, like a gift she had received and had done nothing to acquire. She considered her beauty an accident of fate, like a beautiful singing voice or the ability to paint. Her exceptional looks had turned into a lucrative career. She had paid no attention to it at all when she was younger, and to her it was simply a job. Modelling had opened doors for her, and she was well aware that she couldn't take the men who pursued her seriously. She had no desire for a lasting relationship at her age. She had fun with the men she went out with, but their relationships never lasted for more than a few months. She was invited on yachts and on corporate trips by the companies she worked for. She was sometimes paid to go to parties for publicity purposes, and she never lacked for men to go out with. Her current date was Lord Cyril Buxton, handsome, from an excellent British family, and 27 years old. He was meant to be working for his father at a bank in London, but spent far more time playing in Paris and with her, and avoided his family as much as he was able to, much to his parents' chagrin. Véronique had met them once when she was doing a shoot for British Vogue in London. They were grateful that their son wasn't dating another greedy Russian model who was looking for a rich husband, but they weren't warm to her. They wanted him to fast forward through this stage of his life and get serious about his work and grow up. He had no interest in becoming responsible and giving up his fun life or dating the women they thought he should. They wanted him with a British aristocrat like himself. Cyril had as little interest in marriage as Véronique did. She wasn't sure she'd ever marry. It seemed like an overwhelming commitment to her. Her parents hadn't been married, and it had never bothered her. Her father was American, also an attorney. Her mother had met him while at a legal convention in New York. They had had a passionate affair for 2 years, until Marie-Hélène got pregnant at 41 and realized it might never happen again. She decided to have the baby with Bill's consent. She was 42 when Véronique was born, and Bill Smith was 61. He had died in a car accident when Véronique was 6 months old. Marie-Hélène didn't like to talk about it, and never told Véronique the details of her father's death, only that he had died instantly in a car crash somewhere near New York when a truck hit his sports car on a rainy night. So she had never known her father, only that her parents had loved each other deeply. She had grown up happily alone with her mother, and Véronique had always said that you couldn't miss what you didn't know. She knew her father only from the photographs around their apartment, several in her own room, and the stories her mother told her about him, and how in love they had been. Véronique knew it was true, since there had never been a serious man in her mother's life after him, and she could see from the photographs that he was a handsome man. Once in a while, she wondered what it would be like to have a father, when she saw her friends enjoying a special moment with theirs. But most of the time, she was content with her mother, and spending time occasionally with her friends' fathers growing up. They'd had a brief, bumpy time when Véronique was in her early teens, but that ended quickly, and both women readily admitted that they were best friends. They were proud of how close they were, and respected each other. Véronique always sought her mother's advice, and trusted her wise counsel, except about men. Marie-Hélène still complained about the kind of spoiled, self-indulgent men Véronique dated. They were always after her for the wrong reasons, because of her fame as a supermodel, not for who she was as a person. But Véronique didn't mind. She had fun with them, which was enough for now. She had her own apartment on the Rue de l'Université in the fashionable 7th arrondissement on the left bank, which her mother had let her buy at 21 as a good investment. It was small and useful for her to have her own place. But on weekends, when she had no plans, she often stayed with her mother in the quiet, staid residential 17th arrondissement where she had grown up. It was an upper-middle-class neighbourhood for bourgeois families. Marie-Hélène worked very hard in her law practice, and kept long hours too. They were both hard-working women, with an unusually strong work ethic. Her mother was 64 now, and hadn't had a man in her life in a dozen years, and no one she had ever loved as she had Bill. With Véronique and her law practice, she said she didn't have time, nor the interest. Véronique had asked questions about her father as a child, but Marie-Hélène didn't like to talk about him. She said it made her too sad since his untimely death, so Véronique learned not to press her about it, and didn't want to upset her, even now that she was grown up. She didn't want to make her mother uncomfortable, and she knew as much as there was to know about her father, that he was American and a lawyer, and 61 when she was born. She had never asked her mother why they didn't marry. Several of her friends had unmarried parents while she was growing up, and it wasn't considered unusual or shocking, so that didn't bother her. Marie-Hélène's parents had been straight-laced, old-fashioned aristocrats with very little money. The family chateau, art and furniture had been sold even before Marie-Hélène was born. Her mother had never worked. Her father worked in a dignified, small private bank in Paris. They hoped Marie-Hélène would marry well one day, one of their own kind, and were unhappy when their daughter chose law as a career, but it had been lucrative for her. They hadn't lived long enough to know that she never married and had had a love child, which would have horrified them. Véronique never knew her grandparents. The only relative she had in the world was her mother, and it was enough for her. They didn't live extravagantly, but they lived nicely. Their apartment was genteel, but not luxurious, and big enough for the two of them. It was decorated mostly with Marie-Hélène's parents' remaining antiques. Véronique had no hunger for the glamorous life her own career could have provided her, and although she attended major social events in the fashion world and had an apartment of her own, she was just as happy spending a quiet weekend relaxing and watching TV with her mother in the apartment where she grew up, that had always been home. It seemed perfect to her, and a safe refuge from the fast-moving world where she worked. Her mother was pleased that Véronique's success hadn't spoiled her, and she was always happy to come home. Her own small apartment never felt like home to her. Véronique undressed quickly as soon as she came off the runway, and pushed her way through the crowd backstage to a small changing room where she had left her jeans and T-shirt. She pulled on motorcycle boots and called her mother before she left the Grand Palais, which was a magnificent Victorian glass structure where many fashion shows were held, as well as antique fairs and art events. Marie-Hélène answered on the first ring, as soon as she saw Véronique's number come up. "How was it?" she asked, always pleased to hear from her. She knew how busy her daughter was during Fashion Week, and didn't expect her to call. She never attended the shows herself, which were by invitation only to the fashion elite, but she watched the videos online of every show Véronique was in. "It was fine, nothing unusual," Véronique said. "How are you?" In the madness of Fashion Week, they hadn't spoken in 2 days, which was rare for them. They normally spoke at least once a day. "I'm fine, crazy busy too, though not as busy as you are," Marie-Hélène smiled. She had seen the madness of Fashion Week at close range while Véronique had still lived with her. She missed that now that Véronique had her own apartment, although she came home frequently, for a meal or to spend the night when she had nothing else to do. "I have to go to Brussels next week. I'll probably be there for about 10 days. You can come and see me if you have a break." There was a fast train that got to Brussels from Paris in 1 hour and 20 minutes, and residents of both cities went back and forth with ease, for business or social events. Marie-Hélène had several clients there, since many wealthy families had moved to Belgium and Switzerland when the socialists came into power in France, and the rich began to leave to avoid punitive high taxes. So she went to Belgium frequently to see long-standing clients there. "I'm booked solid for the next 2 weeks with magazine shoots," Véronique told her. "I could come after that if you're still there." "Let's do that, and then go somewhere for a few days. It would do us both good." "I'd love it. I've got a shoot in Tokyo for Vogue after that, but I've got a window in between. It would be fun to get out of here and get some sun. I haven't come up for air in a month," Véronique said, glancing at her watch. "I've got to go, Mum. I've got a motor taxi waiting outside. I've got to be at my next show in 30 minutes for hair and makeup." "I wish that you didn't take those damn motorcycle taxis. They're so dangerous," Marie-Hélène complained. "It's the only way I can get around on a tight schedule." Her mother knew it was true. "How's Cyril, by the way? Is he here?" Marie-Hélène asked her. "Of course," Véronique laughed. "He wouldn't miss Fashion Week. We went to a party Chanel gave 2 days ago, and Dior is giving one tonight. I just want to go home and go to bed, but I know he'll be upset if I don't go." He loved being seen and being in the press with her. It didn't bother her. It was part of the territory and came with who she was. He wouldn't have been dating her if she weren't a supermodel. It annoyed her mother, but Véronique didn't care. They had a good time together. There was a carefree, boyish side to him she thoroughly enjoyed. He acted like a kid at times. "Well, try to get a little rest here and there, and eat occasionally. I'll start thinking about where we can go for a few days. Maybe Miami. It's easy to get to, and warm this time of year." St. Bart's and the Caribbean were more of a scene, and Véronique would be recognized everywhere, which wouldn't be restful for her. Her face was well known around the world. "I love you, Maman," Véronique said hurriedly, put on a warm jacket, and rushed out, pushing her way through the still heavy crowd backstage. She left through a stage entrance and saw the motorcycle taxi waiting for her, along with several others. He had driven her there earlier. All the models were in a hurry to get to the next show they were booked for. She rushed over to the driver as a group of photographers pressed toward her. She put on the helmet the driver handed her and hopped on, and the photographers took rapid-fire photos of her as he started the bike and they made their escape through the Paris traffic. She was at her next location 10 minutes later, in record time, and the madness started all over again with another fashion show. Cyril was at the second one, seated in the second row. He helped her leave afterward in the chauffeur-driven Bentley he had hired to attend the show and was keeping for the evening to take them to the Dior party. It was being held in a private mansion Dior had rented for the occasion. Véronique was exhausted when they got back to her apartment after the show. She had been running all day and for weeks. She'd gotten to bed at 3 a.m. after fittings at Chanel. The sewers had worked all through the night on final touches, and she'd been up at 6 for fittings somewhere else. "If I lie down, I might die," she said to Cyril, as he handed her a glass of champagne. "I don't suppose you'd want to stay home tonight," she said hopefully, and took a sip. "Of course not. Don't be silly. We can't miss the Dior party." She would have been happy to, but didn't want to disappoint him. She wore a fabulous red satin gown they had lent her, which moulded her body and brushed her long chestnut hair loose down her back. She felt like she was sleepwalking by the time they left her apartment, and she almost fell asleep in the Bentley. But she came alive again when they got to the party. She had to admit, it was fun. She saw lots of people she knew, and she and Cyril were photographed constantly while they were dancing, and he was delighted. They left the party at midnight, and he wanted to go dancing at a club. "I can't," she said, stretching her long legs in the back of the limousine. "I have to be up again at 6 tomorrow." Fashion weeks were always like that, a mad dash of shows in the daytime, and an endless round of parties at night. And Cyril didn't want to miss a minute of it. "You work too hard," he said. "My father called today. He wanted to know when I'm coming back. I almost told him never. He's getting cantankerous about my being here. I've only been in Paris this week, for heaven's sake." He hadn't been to Milan with her, although he had come to New York for the show she was in there. "A boy's got to have a bit of fun," he said, kissing her lightly on the lips. But he usually had quite a lot of fun, much to his parents' dismay. It was difficult to pretend he even had a job. Since he worked for his father, he felt he could do whatever he wanted. "What are you doing after the madness is over?" "I've got 2 weeks of shoots booked, and my mother just invited me to go away with her for a few days. I think I might do that."
"Oh, fun! Can I come? I love your mother."
He was like a big kid, or a large unruly dog wagging his tail. It was hard to get angry at him. He was exuberant and lovable, although Véronique wasn't in love with him. But she liked him a lot. "No, you cannot come," she said, laughing at him. "You'll keep me out all night, wanting to go to parties and nightclubs. I want a couple of days of downtime with my mum. I work a hell of a lot harder than you do, and I need a break." He looked mildly disappointed as they arrived at her apartment, and he poured them both another glass of champagne when they got upstairs. Véronique didn't touch hers, and went to get ready for bed, while he enjoyed the view of the Eiffel Tower and finished his champagne. She was already in bed by the time he walked into her bedroom and sat down on the bed next to her. He kissed her amorously and tried to inspire her. She smiled sleepily at him. "I had fun tonight," she said. She enjoyed her time with him and loved dancing with him. She just couldn't party all the time the way he did, and didn't want to. She worked too hard to be out every night, a concept he never understood. At 27, he wanted to have fun all the time. He came to Paris for that, not to sleep. "We should have gone on somewhere to go dancing," he said, and kissed her again. "You're trying to kill me," she said, and he laughed.
"Definitely not. You're way too much fun. Why would I want to kill you?"
"Back in a minute," he said then, and headed for the bathroom. He had been drinking steadily all night, but he was never disagreeable, even when he was drunk, and he had an amazing tolerance for alcohol. He was always a gentleman, no matter how much he drank. He was back 2 minutes later, had taken off his jacket and tie, and was unbuttoning his shirt. She was in bed with her back to him, and he kissed her back and her neck, and was surprised when she didn't respond. He bent over her and kissed her with mounting passion, and then saw that she was sound asleep. It had been a very long day for her, and an endless 4 weeks. "Oh, well," he said with a smile, and walked back out to the living room to finish the bottle of champagne. Véronique was dead to the world.
Chapter 2. Cyril spent the next 2 weeks in Paris with Véronique.
He slept late, got massages, and had lunch with friends while Véronique went to her photo shoots and honoured her commitments. They met at night to have dinner or go to parties she was invited to, or that he'd wangled invitations to on his own. Knowing she would be with him, people invited him to everything nowadays. She was his entree to the most elite closed jet-set circles, and even though she worked long hours at the shoots, it was much less demanding and stressful than the fashion shows were, and she was game to go out with him in the evening. His father was fuming in London, and Cyril didn't care. He was a spoiled only son who had not lived up to their expectations yet, and maybe never would. Véronique was used to men like him who behaved more like boys. He wasn't much older than she was, only 5 years. He loved to have a good time and was addicted to beautiful women. It was a breed that was familiar to her, the men who chased supermodels. Cyril was a prime example. Cyril said openly that Véronique was the most beautiful girl he had ever known, and she was smart too. She saw right through him, which he found amusing. There was no artifice to Cyril. He never pretended to be something he wasn't, and he never made promises he couldn't keep. He lived by an honour code according to his upbringing, which in his case didn't include work. He had no desire to grow up and wanted to play for as many years as he could get away with. She made no demands on him and didn't want anything from him materially. As far as Cyril was concerned, she was the ideal woman, and they had the perfect relationship. Even her mother couldn't get too angry with him, although she deplored his lack of work ethic, but he was just an overgrown child in a handsome young man's body, with no malice to him, and he treated Véronique well. He was a gentleman and a kind man. Véronique's plans to go away with her mother had firmed up, and they were both looking forward to it. They had decided on Miami, which was just glitzy and corny enough to appeal to both of them, and the shopping was great.
"That's not fair," Cyril complained when he heard Véronique make plans with her mother on the phone. "I want to come too."
"You can't," Véronique said bluntly, laughing at him, "unless you want your father to kill you or disinherit you."
"Oh, that! He takes things much too seriously," Cyril said lightheartedly. "Why don't I at least come to Brussels with you for the night? I'll invite you and your mother to dinner, and we can all go to the airport together the next day. I'll fly back to London, and you and your mother can go to Miami and abandon me to freezing London weather and my dreary existence at home. I'll come back in a few weeks. Or will you be away then?" He could hardly keep up with her schedule.
"I'm going to Tokyo after Miami, but after that I'll be home for a few weeks."
She enjoyed the trips for photo shoots as long as they weren't too dangerous or in very primitive places.
"I wish I had your life," he said enviously.
"No, you don't. I work much harder than you do," she reminded him, and he didn't deny it.
"You get to play a lot too," he reminded her,
but he also knew that she went out less than most of the models he had met, those who were looking for a good time and a wealthy man. Véronique was impressively self-sufficient, and she expected nothing from him. He suspected she wouldn't cheat on him, which was rare in her world too. Morals tended to be fast and loose in the crowd they both moved in. She was undemanding, always fun to be with, intelligent, and spectacularly beautiful. It was all he wanted in a woman. He even liked her mother, a direct, honest, open, incredibly bright, interesting woman who had had a long, impressive career in the law. He liked talking to Marie-Hélène more than he did his own mother, who complained all the time about how difficult the servants were, how hard his father worked, and how much time he spent hunting and at his club. They gave a lot of weekend parties at their country estate in Kent, which bored Cyril to tears. With no objection from her mother, Véronique agreed to let Cyril come to Brussels with her for the night, and they all planned to leave early the next day, heading off in opposite directions. Véronique and Cyril took the fast train to Brussels on Monday afternoon. She dozed on the train and he answered emails on his computer. He sent Véronique an email telling her he loved her, and she smiled when she saw it on her phone when she woke up.
He caught up on the news and read that the main terrorist responsible for the November attacks in Paris had been arrested in Brussels 2 days before. They were both in high spirits as they took a cab to the apartment where Marie-Hélène stayed when she worked in Brussels. She was concluding her work that day with her last appointments with her clients, and she was going to meet Véronique and Cyril at the apartment by dinner time. Véronique had already complained that they were taking such an early flight to Florida and had to check in at 8 a.m. the next day, but Marie-Hélène didn't want to waste a minute of their mini-vacation. They were only planning to stay in Florida for 3 days.
"It works for me anyway," Cyril assured her. "I'll get to the bank early so my father won't be pissed at me."
Véronique set the table for her mother when they got to the apartment, and Cyril had brought a bottle of very fine red wine. Since they had to get up early, they had decided to dine at home. When Marie-Hélène got home, she had bought foie gras and a cooked chicken and some sausages, and they had an easy, casual dinner in the small kitchen. Cyril had generously offered to take them to a nice restaurant, but it was easier to eat in. They had a lovely evening, chatting in the kitchen, and Cyril made them both laugh with tales of his parents' house party hunting weekends.
"I avoid them whenever possible. They're positively deadly boring," he said, as they finished his bottle of excellent wine.
Marie-Hélène was elated to be going away with her daughter, and Véronique was excited too.
"I'm going to look like a slob all weekend," she warned her mother. "I don't care who takes my picture. I don't want to see decent clothes for the whole 3 days, and I warn you, Mom, I'm travelling in my worst old jeans."
Her mother smiled at her.
"I don't care if you travel in your pyjamas. I'm just happy we could both find the time to get away together."
Marie-Hélène had planned it carefully to make the time.
"Stop talking about your trip,"
Cyril grumbled as they cleared up after dinner.
"I'm green with envy. I'm going back into slavery and grisly, dark, freezing cold London. It's in very poor taste for you two to gloat about it. You have no compassion whatsoever."
"No, I don't," Véronique said as she kissed him. "I've worked my ass off for the past 6 weeks." Her mother worked hard, too. They all went to bed early, Cyril and Véronique in the apartment's second bedroom, and met in the kitchen the following morning at 6, while Marie-Hélène made coffee and toast for all three of them. They were all half asleep, and no one chattered as they had the night before. They went back to their rooms to shower and dress, and were ready right on time. Marie-Hélène and Véronique with a small suitcase each to check in, and Cyril was wearing a proper business suit, white shirt, Hermes tie, and a navy cashmere overcoat. He looked very handsome.
"You look very nice when you go to work," Véronique complimented him as they got into a cab to go to Zaventem Airport.
"Thank you," Cyril said glumly, and looked as though he wished he were going anywhere but back to London. Marie-Hélène and Véronique were speaking softly to each other about their trip. He had a small suitcase with him too, and had left some clothes at Véronique's apartment in Paris. He carried the bags into the terminal for them, and accompanied them to their check-in, in true gentlemanly fashion. He had time to get to his own plane after that.
"That's very sweet of you," Marie-Hélène thanked him, as they stood in the check-in line together.
It was 5 to 8, and they were perfectly on time. He stood patiently behind them with the bags.
"What do you think if we..."
Véronique said to her mother, and never got to finish her sentence. As she said it, at 2 minutes to 8 o'clock, there was the sound of a massive explosion. A bomb exploded several feet from where they were standing in the departures terminal. The bomb blew a huge hole in the building as parts of the roof and beams came crashing down on them. Twisted metal and broken glass rained on the waiting passengers in line. People were screaming and running in all directions to get away from the heart of the explosion. Within seconds, a second bomb exploded at the other end of the departures terminal. There were bodies and injured people on the floor everywhere. Some of them with huge pieces of steel lying on top of them, several of them obviously dead. Dark smoke was heavy in the air. Véronique looked around her to find her mother and Cyril and couldn't see them anywhere in the thick black smoke that surrounded them. And then she realized, when she tried to run, that she was lying on the floor under a heavy slab of metal that was crushing her. She could not move or go anywhere or even make a sound. She could hear screaming and shouts in the distance and sirens shortly after. She couldn't feel her body and was dazed and in shock. No one could see her where she lay, and no one came to her aid. All she could do was hope that Cyril and her mother were okay. She felt strangely light, as though she were floating, and the sounds around her faded into the distance as she drifted in and out of consciousness. She kept waiting to hear her mother's voice near her, and called out to her a few times, but no sound came from her mouth, as she lay under the beams and pieces of the roof of the terminal. It seemed like hours before she heard voices coming closer, but it didn't sound like her mother or Cyril. They were men's voices. She felt her body get even lighter, and she was sure she was floating away, and then there were bright lights in her eyes, but she couldn't distinguish forms or faces. She wondered if she was dying or had already died. She heard a voice speaking distinctly in French. "No, she's dead," someone said decisively, and then she felt hands on her neck and heard more shouting. Whoever they were talking about was alive and not dead, and she had no idea who it was and had no awareness that they were talking about her. She heard heavy metal grinding sounds and machinery that sounded too loud in her ears, and the weight she had felt for what seemed like hours lifted off of her, and someone said, "Oh my God," and then she felt herself being lifted up and laid down somewhere. It didn't hurt when they moved her. She was completely numb. A woman's voice asked her name, and she told them. "My mother, Cyril," she whispered, as she had the sensation of flying or moving very quickly as the paramedics put her on a gurney and rushed her to an ambulance. She was covered with blood, with shrapnel wounds covering her entire body, which she wasn't aware of. The clothes she had worn were only shreds after the explosion. The floor around her was littered with hundreds of injured, moaning people and body parts, which had flown through the air and landed helter-skelter everywhere. She had no way of knowing that a third bomb had exploded at Malbec metro station an hour after the attack at the airport. 16 people lay dead at the airport, and another 16 at the metro station. Between the two locations, first responders were dealing with 340 severely wounded people, with unimaginable injuries from the homemade bombs made of household chemicals and peroxide and filled with nails and bolts and pieces of metal to intentionally tear bodies apart and cause even greater harm than just from the explosion. There was so much blood on Véronique's face that no one could have identified her, even her own mother. Their bodies had not been identified yet, but Marie-Hélène and Cyril had been killed instantly in the first explosion, and their bodies still lay beneath the rubble. It was a miracle that Véronique had survived it. She looked so severely damaged and so lifeless that the paramedics on the scene were sure she was dead when they lifted the piece of the roof off of her. They were certain that she had suffered countless broken bones and massive internal injuries, and her face was unrecognizable under all the encrusted blood, with gashes all over her face and body. She was lying almost naked when they discovered her. She slipped into unconsciousness as soon as she whispered her name in answer to the question. Like the rest of the wounded, she was taken to a nearby military hospital, which was better equipped to treat injuries of this nature. These were wartime injuries, from massive explosions, normally never experienced by civilians. Véronique was one of the last to arrive at the hospital, and was rushed into surgery immediately. There were people on gurneys crowding the halls, waiting for rooms and operating rooms to open up, as nurses and doctors did triage up and down the halls. Less severe injuries were being treated by paramedics, but there were very few minor injuries. Most were very extreme, with some of the victims burned on their entire bodies, and others who had suffered severed limbs. One woman had lost both arms and both legs. Children were being treated as a priority. Belgian officials had sprung into action. 3 suicide bombers died in the explosions, but they had taken 32 souls with them and injured over 300 others. It was a massive terrorist attack on Brussels. The police had been following leads on other terrorists concealed in the city, but had not succeeded in rounding them up and stopping them in time. Véronique spent 7 hours in surgery that night to remove the vast quantities of metal and shrapnel that had entered her body. It would require many operations, but they attempted to remove the most acute pieces, which were the most dangerous and were threatening her arteries. She was categorized at the highest degree of critical and never regained consciousness again after giving her name. The surgeons worked diligently to save her and to treat the deep lacerations on her face. Bernard Aubert was sitting in the office he had shared with Marie-Hélène Vincent for 30 years. He had first heard the news of the attack in Brussels on his way to work that morning. He knew that Marie-Hélène had been in Brussels for 2 weeks, but assumed she would be taking the high-speed train back to Paris. She had told him she was taking the rest of the week off, but hadn't told him she was going to Miami. Unlike Véronique, she hadn't been carrying a purse, but had a belt with a money purse around her waist, with her passport in it, and since he was listed as the person to notify in case of emergency on her official papers, the Brussels police called him that afternoon. Bernard was 65 years old and had been divorced for years. He was planning to retire at the end of the year and had told Marie-Hélène his intentions a few months before. They had been practicing law in their shared practice for 30 years. He considered her a close friend and had a deep affection and respect for her. And he was in shock when they told him that she had died at Zaventem Airport. They questioned him about another victim with the same surname. They said that they had a Véronique Vincent at the hospital, listed as severely critical. She was still in surgery at the time. "Oh my God, that's her daughter. I didn't know she was with her." They told him that he would be kept closely informed. But if she survived, the doctor's intention was to put her in a medically induced coma after the surgery, and she was expected to have more surgeries in the next few days. He was shaking when he hung up and burst into tears. He couldn't believe what had happened, that Marie-Hélène had been killed and Véronique was fighting for her life. Since she wasn't conscious, he decided to wait before he went to Brussels. He could offer no comfort or help in the circumstances. Their secretaries and paralegal and a junior associate who was working on some of their cases all moved around the office as quietly as they could, devastated by the news. Bernard looked grey as he sat at his desk, alternately crying and staring into space. It was a cruel end for his colleague and dear friend, and even more tragic if her daughter died too, at 22. The reports on television of the bombings were harrowing, with terrifying photographs of the departures terminal after the 2 bombs exploded, and the metro station. A 3rd bomb had been found at the airport, which hadn't detonated. A terrorist group had claimed responsibility for the attack, which was believed to be tied to the November attacks in Paris 4 months before. Bernard waited until the next day to go to Brussels, and was only permitted to see Véronique for a few minutes in the intensive care unit. She was deep in a controlled coma after the surgery. He spoke to the doctor in charge of her care and was told that her survival was still gravely in question. Her body was still full of shrapnel, some in critical locations. They had removed as much as they could for now, but by no means all. And if she did survive, she would do so with some shrapnel in her body forever. Removing some pieces of it was just too dangerous. She was at risk for losing an eye as well. Bernard saw that her face was heavily bandaged, and the doctor told him that she would need reconstructive surgery for the damage to her face, and she had suffered internal damage to her vital organs as well. He cried again while listening to the doctor, and knew how heartbroken Marie-Hélène would have been to know the condition her daughter was in. The doctor estimated that she had a 15-20% chance of survival, but was not optimistic. The only thing in her favour was that she had youth on her side, which would help her recover if she survived her injuries. The people who had built the bombs had maximized the damage they could cause to the human body, and had done so very effectively. It was small consolation that the bombers were dead as well. Véronique was scheduled for another surgery in 2 days to continue to remove the shrapnel that was threatening her life. The risk of infection and septicemia from the filth with which the bomb was made was great. The apartment where they had been built had been discovered by then, and the bombs identified as triacetone triperoxide bombs, similar to those in the Paris attacks. The components were all items easily obtained in pharmacies and hardware stores. Bernard went back to Paris on the train that night, with a heavy heart after what he'd been told. They had promised to call him as soon as they had further news. Once home, he called the hospital every few hours for news of Véronique. She was not expected to regain consciousness for several months, after many additional surgeries. After those to save her major organs, there would be the cosmetic ones. The doctor had said that it would be impossible to determine for some time the degree of visible damage to her face and body, but they expected it to be severe. It was possible that Véronique might be unrecognizable if she survived, even after reconstructive surgery. They had said that they would need photographs of her eventually, if she survived, to replicate her face as closely as they could. But he warned Bernard not to expect a miracle. She would look very different if she survived. Finding photographs of her was the one thing that would be easy. All they had to do was buy any magazine on the stands, and she would be in it. They didn't sound optimistic about the results they could achieve, given the extensive damage that she had sustained in the blast. She had been standing shockingly close to the bomb when it was detonated. He lay awake all night and felt sick every time he thought of her. She was so young to be in such a dire situation, with so much damage. He realized, too, that they had not made the connection to who she was, which was just as well. The last thing they needed was to have the press all over her, saying that her face had been destroyed. They had bigger problems on their hands without the press adding more drama for Véronique to have to cope with when she regained consciousness. He just prayed that she would. She was going to have so much to deal with, as well as the heartbreak of losing her mother. Bernard was the executor of Marie-Hélène's estate, all of which had been left to the benefit of her daughter. Véronique would be well cared for forever. But what kind of life would she have now if her face was destroyed? She was such a young, beautiful girl. Véronique had lost her mother and her career in a single instant. Bernard couldn't imagine it. As he sat awake long into the night, with the tears sliding down his cheeks,